Well, it's great to be back at a Philadelphia Society meeting, even greater to be up here at the lectern. Thanks to Bill Campbell for thinking of me. Thanks also to my old friend, Larry Arn, for his kind introduction and his sobering remarks. I've known Larry for a long time. He's gone on to do great things, contrary to my expectations when I first met him. How can we transmit the permanent things? This topic, I think, is incredibly difficult and multifaceted for, I'm going to give you three reasons, only three. I could give you a lot of reasons, but I'll reduce them to three. My students like lists. I tend to like lists, too. So here are three reasons I think this question is complicated just on the surface of it. The first is the what question. What do we mean by the permanent things? Second, the how question. How do we transmit them once we have some sense of what they are? And this, in turn, raises two sub-questions. My questions always have sub-questions, it seems. The how question, how might we transmit them in, let's say, a theoretical way? For example, what sorts of studies might be necessary for and conducive to this transmission? But also, how might we engage in the art of transmission in a practical way? How exactly do we go about it, given the forces in the American Academy that line up against such transmission? Dr. Arn mentioned some of the most recent and insidious ones, but there are many more. Third, most conservatives sense that transmission of the permanent things has something to do with what we like to call a proper liberal education, which Dr. Corey touched on. Yet liberal education is a vexed phrase, one which has been co-opted by the left to mean something like this: liberating students from the purported prejudices they bring with them to college, prejudices they imbibed from the hegemony of their parents or churches or other civic institutions. So we have to think carefully and ask the right questions about the kind of liberal education we're willing to embrace in order to transmit what we like to call the permanent things. Now, I've got very little time, so I'm going to try and blend my answers to these questions together a bit as I sketch how we might, at least in my estimation, transmit the permanent things. But I wanted to separate out the questions formally to begin with so that we can see the different dimensions of the problem. I'm interested in all of these questions, largely because I'm a college teacher. And in particular, I'm a teacher of political things, civic things, which are not exactly identical with the permanent things, which takes us back to the what question. But nonetheless, civic learning, it seems to me, helps to serve as a prolegomenon to an appreciation of the permanent things, precisely because to know and examine seriously the strengths and weaknesses, the good and the bad of one's own way of life, opens one to knowing the good simply. This is a lesson that Socrates taught. It's also the case in America that the principles and practices of American republicanism are deeply rooted, I think, in a natural law tradition stretching back to antiquity. In other words, American civic institutions, properly understood, rest on the permanent things. So underneath the hurly-burly of everyday American politics, what's going on inside the Beltway, students can catch now and then a glimmer of the eternal if their studies are properly directed. Despite the seeming importance, then, of civic learning, both for the functioning of society and for the access it might provide to the permanent things beyond mere human society, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that civic learning is not taken seriously in the American university. In fact, a recent series of studies, which some of you might be familiar with by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, demonstrate not only that many of America's most elite institutions fail when it comes to civic education, they actually produce negative civic learning. That is, graduating seniors demonstrate less knowledge of civic things, in particular political principles, economic principles, history, literature, than incoming freshmen do. That giant sucking sound you hear on college campuses is not simply the emptying of the last keg, but basic civic literacy being extracted from the brains of our 18 to 22-year-olds. The very brightest ones who go to the best colleges. America was recently blessed with a pretty decent chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a fellow by the name of Bruce Cole. NEH isn't always so blessed as presidential appointees. NEH chairman varied dramatically with a lot of political and cultural trends. Bruce Cole, I think, was a pretty good one. Cole said that we in America are increasingly suffering from a collective or cultural amnesia. And I think that's right. Now, of course, all cultures, all civilizations suffer in some way from this. The passage of time contributes invariably to cultural amnesia to one degree or another, to a forgetfulness of one's civic identity. As Abraham Lincoln so eloquently said, with America's founding generation having passed, no one living having any direct contact with them, the silent artillery of time cannot help but erase their great contributions from our collective memories. The disturbing thing is not the reality of this erasing, but that in America, the great institutions we've created, particularly academic institutions, offer little or nothing to slow or halt this process of forgetting. Indeed, in many cases, they actually try to accelerate it, telling us that our great civic achievements are nothing but the legacy of a dead, irrelevant past, or worse still, something that should be actively shunned by us, the living. American universities might well be the envy of the world when it comes to the natural sciences, but when it comes to civic education, education in who we are as a people, an education in philosophy, politics, religion, history, literature, economic principles, all the things missing from the new dispensation that Larry Arnn described, and furthermore, the connection of these matters to the permanent things, our institutions as a group, I think, are in a doleful state. Our schools and universities have robbed American students of the riches of their heritage. Without these riches, American students and those who will become national leaders are unlikely to see or fully appreciate the manifold benefits that their society has conferred on them. And consequently, I think, we can expect their civic and political choices to be poor. A scholarship of civic education, if it is to be reinvigorated and worthy of the name, must in some important sense be patriotic, and therefore not be an entirely liberating or liberal education, at least as liberal education is commonly understood nowadays. It must ground students in the truths of their regime, their way of life, that point them to the larger truths of the human experience, the permanent things. So those of us interested in civic education, I have a couple of very tough nuts to crack, it seems to me. First, we have to arouse interest in and commitment to the idea of civic education, just the bare idea of it, and then argue for its patriotic character in the context of a larger liberal arts framework, or in many cases simply a business-oriented framework that a lot of colleges are moving towards. Now, of course, I don't mean to suggest that universities should engage in an uncritical celebration of or education only in things American. What I'm arguing for, and what I practice where I teach, is a curriculum firmly rooted in the great books of Western civilization and the great political writings of the American tradition, America in context, as it were. We need, in short, a broad-gauge core curriculum that begins by dilating on our origins in classical antiquity, starting with the Greek world and the Bible, truth and consequences. Students, I think, would learn many things if this were done in a sympathetic way by the kinds of instructors that Elizabeth Corey described. I'll mention just two of the things. Students would, for example, discover, it turns out, not just our intellectual, but our civic origins begin in the Greek philosophical tradition. The Greeks gave us something that makes us who we are. In a word, they gave us philosophy. Not today's often dry academic discipline, prone to be as cut off from the rest of the modern university as it is from life itself, but philosophically philosophy as the love of wisdom, philosophy as eros, longing for the highest things, the permanent things. It's in philosophy, the ceaseless questioning characteristic of Greek philosophic inquiry, that we find a major root of Western freedom, which is so nobly played out in that form of life and government we know today as liberal democracy. Question authority, our friends on the left say, and many times our friends on the libertarian side of things. Well, it turns out that Socrates, alike with Antigone and many others, have already been there, done that. But they did it with a particular purpose in mind, of supplanting or supplementing defective political authority with something that transcends ordinary politics, with some version of the permanent things. Students might also learn the lesson that Tomas, the hero of Milan Kundera's great novel Unbearable Lightness of Being, imparts to his friends as he gazes on the laughing, heavy-drinking communist functionaries who claim they didn't know of the crimes of communism. Oedipus, Tomas says, also didn't know of his crimes against nature. But when he discovered them, he gouged out his own eyes and removed himself from the throne. Morality, Tomas concludes with devastating understatement, has changed since Oedipus. There's a real story, I think, to be told here in the great books. It's a story that's far from an arid archaeological dig. It's a story that teaches us not merely about a distant past, but about ourselves, the kind of civic order that we have created. It's a story about the intellectual gifts of our civilization, and it's a story that can be told, must be told, without obvious condescension on the part of the instructor, a common attitude nowadays when such matters are taught at all. Again, it comes down to having the right teachers teaching the right things. As an aside, a story I always like to tell, I distinctly recall being on a job search committee for a tenure-track social sciences position at the college at which I teach, a self-described Catholic Benedictine liberal arts college. One of the candidates was asked by one or two of the concerned committee members, I was one of those committee members, what the candidate thought of Western civilization. That's surely a question broad and interesting enough to elicit a number of broad and interesting responses, one would think. Instead, the candidate replied incredulously with a simple, "What's that?" with an emphasis on the "that." The question seemed to this young PhD-bearing citizen arrogant, irrelevant, unanswerable, perhaps all three. It was as if, as it were, the committee members were speaking Greek. We live in an era of academic specialization conjoined with condescension or ignorance, and often both, on the part of too many senior faculty members who produce the new humanists and social scientists, those who are to become the teachers and scholars of tomorrow. Ignorance and condescension have produced mirabile dictu, amnesia, perhaps the ultimate weapon of mass destruction aimed at our country, culture, and civilization, resulting ultimately in oblivion of eternity. Even those of scholarly bent, nay, I think especially those, seem no longer capable of holding their arms outstretched in love toward the further shore. So we're left with important questions. Can liberal education be revived under such circumstances? Perhaps more pressingly, should it be, if we also wish it to be civic education? I hope that the answer is yes. But for those of us who hope for an education that is at once liberal and civic, one that opens our students to the permanent things, we must be attentive to the truths of our regime. If and only if they are truths, as opposed to mere conventions, it seems to me, can liberal education, civic education, and at least an openness to the permanent things be brought into some harmony? Because the truth is something from which we cannot, ought not, be liberated. And so, we must teach the full range of reasons, institutions, habits, customs, and prejudgments that support those truths. So an education that is at once liberal and civic and attentive to the permanent can start with Greece and the Bible, but it must move through Aquinas, the common law of England, Shakespeare, Locke, Adam Smith, the Federalist and Anti-Federalist writings, Lincoln, and many others, and contrast them with the progressive revolt against any natural permanent truths that transcend the mere processes of evolution. In the end, the job of educators, teachers, is not simply to transmit a desire to be critical, for the youth, you might have noticed, already have that in abundance, but a desire to acquire wisdom and the kind of character, the kind of moral virtues that make them fearless in pursuing wisdom, in defending its very existence in a world that says nothing is simply. The fool says in his heart, there is no God, and the contemporary American Academy in this sense is nothing if not full of fools. So we must try at the institutional and individual levels to encourage inquiry, critical consciousness, liberal, patriotic, attentive to the permanent things, through the reading, once again, of the great books. That's my theoretical answer to the question, how can we transmit the permanent things? But how practically do we do it when the world conspires against it? My practical part of the answer only requires four times as much time as my theoretical part, so don't feel. No, I'm going to be very brief and sum up here. To accomplish this on a practical level, we need a range of practical political skills that allows us to build and defend enclaves within the modern academy. And by those enclaves, I mean especially academic departments and college-based centers dedicated to the scholarly exposition of freedom, Western civilization, and the American experience. And there I shamelessly quote the motto of my own center, freedom, Western civilization, and the American experience. Along with political skills, of course, we need a good deal of luck when we go about this. But fortune, Machiavelli instructs us, is a woman, and she is fickle. So it turns out, along with the Bible, we must read our Florentine friend as we take advantage, rather ruthlessly, as it were, of every opportunity to raise the Jolly Roger and seize back from the authorities, from the man who controls the wealth and power within the academy, that which we can. As conservatives, we can't be afraid to insert our tie-dyed pocket squares, take over the dean's office, and upset a few apple carts, letting our friends on the left know that their old road is rapidly aging. For I believe that one of the permanent things is hunger for the permanent things, especially among the young. And even the American Academy can't eradicate that. That almost sounds optimistic, which is not like me at all. As a conservative, optimism is not permitted me, but hope springs eternal. In the words of Robert Louis Stevenson, if I could show you these men and women all the world over in every stage of history, under every abuse of error, under every circumstance of failure, without hope, without help, without thanks, still obscurely fighting the lost fight of virtue, still clinging in the brothel or on the scaffold to some rag of honor, the poor jewel of their souls. They may seek to escape, and yet they cannot. They are condemned to some nobility all their lives long. The desire of good is at their heels, the implacable hunter. Thank you.